Hello, and welcome to Eyes on Success, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete. Well, this week we're going to talk with a person who is blind since birth and worked hard to become a practicing physician.
We'll talk with Tim Cordes about how he got into medical school, how he got through medical school, as well as some of the joys and challenges of being a practicing blind psychiatrist. And towards the end of this show, we'll be talking with him about a program that he wrote that should help all chemistry students and chemists to envision molecular structures of chemical compounds. But first, for our tip of the week. This week's tip comes from Tim.
What I always tell people is, you know, they say it takes confidence to do these things without vision. And I think it's arrogant to say things aren't possible, because that assumes you know all the variables. And, you know, it's only when we're humble that we open ourselves up to the possibilities that really are out there.
And this is yet another testament to the fact that if you're driven and you work hard and there's something you really want to do, there's usually a way to do it. You don't generally think of blind people going into the field of practicing medicine and becoming physicians, but that was Tim's dream, and he made it happen. And we'll be talking about that throughout the show.
Well, and in addition to being ambitious and driven, you also have to be your own advocate, and Tim certainly exhibited that behavior as well.
And he had a lot of support from his parents.
Let's start by meeting Tim Cordes.
My name's Tim Cordes. I'm a practicing psychiatrist who happens to be blind. I grew up in Iowa. I did some undergraduate biochemistry at the University of Notre Dame, and then went and got an MD and a PhD degree at the University of Wisconsin, and went on to a psychiatry residency and specialize in helping people with addictive disorders.
I take it from your bio that you've been blind for a considerably long time?
Yeah, so I have Leber's congenital amaurosis, among some other eye pathologies. I could read with magnification as a kid, but was to Braille and speech by early high school and using a cane and a dog around that time too.
So before you went to college, you had all the blindness skills you needed in order to get through college successfully?
I did. And it was, I'm so glad. You know, I had some usable vision with magnification when I was a child learning Braille, and I was reluctant, but my teachers and my parents were insistent that I learn Braille. And, you know, I am so grateful I did at that time.
And you must credit your parents a lot for giving you the support to go through all this. I mean, certainly growing up young and visually impaired, you do need some different kinds of support.
Yeah, definitely. I had such a wonderful mix. My father is an engineer. He's a problem solver. And so when we'd meet a challenge, he would help me figure out ways to address it. My mom was more emotionally supportive, and my two older sisters were challenging and were going to make sure that, you know, I didn't get it too easy and I did my chores. And the combination of that, I am so fortunate.
That's a big thing.
Yeah.
So I understand you have some hobbies, pastimes, other interests that aren't very typical of visually impaired people?
Well, I've done things of that nature. Right now, my major, you know, next interest is my family, and they rightfully get a lot of my time. So some of those other hobbies have taken a bit of a backseat. But yeah, you know, I've studied the martial arts.
I understand you have several black belts.
Yeah, well, it was a joint style, so I have a black belt in Taekwondo and in Jiu-Jitsu.
We actually did a show where we interviewed some guy who's got, what did he say, a third-degree black belt in, I don't know, three different martial arts, and some of them use weapons, and I'm like, oh, good, you know, want to be a sparring partner with some guy with a long sword who can't see, but he manages to keep it safe for everybody, and apparently does quite well with it.
Yeah, no, that was the right thing for me to do at the right time. It helped me have something outside of school. It helped me work on my discipline. It was very good.
Well, as you say, there are different phases of our lives. Some of that may be behind you, but a family can certainly take up a lot of time and be a lot of enjoyment.
Yeah.
We remember going through that phase too.
Yep. I had a trusted colleague who one day said, you know, every kid is like a full-time job. And so I take that to heart.
Mm-hmm. And you have two of them, right?
Yeah. Yep.
How old are they?
6 and 4.
Ah, great ages.
Right, right.
And that show about doing martial arts was number 1229, and we will have a link to that in the show notes for this show.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. Success, 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 success.
This week's focus topic is the process and associated challenges of becoming a physician as a blind person. The primary thing that we're interested in talking to you about is how you were able to overcome obstacles to, first of all, get into medical school and then get through medical school. Because a blind person applying to medical school is not something that a lot of people with small imaginations would figure out could happen.
Right. Yeah, first I started with the basics, which anybody would do. I tried to get the best grades I could. I did research. I got reference letters and built a resume on paper that I thought could compete. It actually turns out one of my letter writers wrote his entire letter of recommendation, and the last sentence was, "And Tim Cordes is blind." So I think that's kind of how I tried to do it. And then I knocked on a lot of doors, and some places gave me a shot. Some people brought me in for the interview and politely told me that there was no way I was getting into their medical school. And luckily, I cast my net broadly enough and wound up at the University of Wisconsin. I applied both to the MD, well, the MD-PhD program, so that they could conceive of me as a physician scientist. And I think the fact that I wanted to be a scientist as well might have helped grease the skids for me getting in as a physician.
Which is interesting because in general, it's a lot harder to get into the MD-PhD program than just the regular MD program.
Yep. Yeah, that is true. But I think in my case, I think it worked out in my favor.
How old were you when you thought you might want to become a doctor?
I was pretty old, actually. I went to college thinking I wanted to be a scientist or a researcher, but it wasn't until maybe my sophomore or junior year that I started thinking about it more seriously. I read a great book, White Coat, White Cane, by David Hartman, who's a blind psychiatrist, and that was inspirational to me as well.
And we will have a link to where you can get hold of that book also in the show notes for this show. So you were in college in the 1990s, I gather?
Yep, yep.
What kind of accommodations did they make you with textbooks and other written materials?
I used a lot of Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic at the time. I think it's Learning Ally now. So I worked with them for all the textbooks I could. There were a few textbooks we shipped out to a firm that scanned them. And for the literature books and the philosophy books, I actually scanned those manually by myself. And then there were reader services, technology I had, JAWS, and then JAWS for Windows on a PC. I think that was my PC. And those are sort of the major accommodations.
And I take it you did pretty well in school.
Yeah, I did. I did pretty well. I got 1 A-, and the rest were A's, so pretty well.
Now, you talked about how you cast your net very widely in order to get into medical school because you knew there'd be some resistance there. And, you know, although you had a very high grade point average, it still sounded like it was difficult to, find a place that would accept you. When you did find that place that would accept you, what was the conversation like with them? How reluctant were they? How much talking did you have to do in order to, you know, sort of sell yourself?
The interview was the usual. I went in and I talked to several professors about their research and what I might be interested in. And I met with some people from the medical school. And, you know, the interview day was much the same as other places. I just didn't get the talk at the end that said, well, you know, thanks for applying. Don't let the door hit you on the way out. So that conversation went on. I thought it went fine. And, you know, I left, and for a few weeks I didn't hear anything from them. And I was actually in the process of working on a demo tape to be a DJ in Alaska when I got the call from Wisconsin, and it was the head of the MD PhD program, Brad Schwartz, and he said, "Listen, Tim, we'd like you to come." And after that, it, you know, there was talk about how do we accommodate, but it wasn't do we, it was how do we, and that makes all the difference.
Oh, that's very good.
Did he ever talk to you about any of these conversations he had to have with the rest of the people on the admissions committee about talking them into it? Or was this just everybody at Wisconsin was on the same page?
I wasn't naive enough to think everybody was on the same page, but I knew, you know, a plurality or a majority of them, you know, were willing to give it a shot.
Well, it's interesting. I think sometimes with a very accomplished person like yourself, the blindness can almost be an asset. And sometimes, you know, people who are a little bit more open and accepting may say, boy, this person did so well despite his visual impairment. I think he'll do just as well when he gets here. Whereas other people are more, you know, reluctant, and they may say, well, I just don't want to think about this.
Yeah, I think it's possible. And I think it's also possible that someone who goes through the training with a visual impairment, you know, will see problems differently and will analyze data differently in a way that can be an asset. So I think that's another way to look at it.
Yeah, I was surprised when I came to Xerox, you know, I asked people after the fact about, you know, what their thinking was in taking me and was there any reluctance? And I think, you know, that was part of their answer was, you know, we thought, geez, if you did that well in graduate school and got your PhD in physics, then you were probably going to succeed wherever you went. So we didn't think about it.
Right, right.
But I didn't advertise the fact when I was sending out my resumes. I never put that in my resume. And, you know, I just let them make their judgment when they met me in person.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to recall if I put it in my personal statement or not. I think I assumed that at least one of my recommenders would. So I think I did address it somewhere in my application.
Mm-hmm. You never quite know what to do in that situation. I've heard people doing it both ways.
Right, right.
So once you got into medical school, a number of the courses can be thought to require vision. What kind of accommodations did you make in medical school?
Yeah, well, anatomy, you know, some people might think requires vision, but where the other students were tested by having to look at part of a dissection and identify something, I got to use my hands to feel it. I did get a little extra time for that. There's a class called histology, which is all about what tissues look like, especially under the microscope. The other students would get a slide projected in the auditorium on their exam. An instructor would make a raised line, a representation, and then I could ask questions about color. Is this region purple or pink? But not in a way that really gave anything away. And so that's how we learned the tissues. And so with the combination of readers and those accommodations and electronic materials whenever available, that's how we did it.
So I'm kind of curious, when I started graduate school, I didn't get many of my books from what was then Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic on time. And I found that my peers in graduate school were very helpful and offered to read for me and do what they could. I'm wondering how your colleagues in medical school took all this.
Overall, you know, they were really helpful. Everybody was very busy. A lot of the course materials were delivered from the professors in what they called modules. So they were sort of these pre-digested handouts and outlines. And luckily, since the professors made them in Word in the first place, usually I could just get those in electronic format. So a lot of that was easy. By that time, too, some of the textbooks, like the Harrison's textbook for internal medicine, was available on CD. So I started doing that when I could. And then some of the other texts were older and they were available from RFB&D.
So a lot of your material was available electronically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, I guess the pictures must have been the most difficult things to handle. You know, the geometry of chemicals and things like that.
That's pretty easy in medical school, you know, in a strict sense, because it's abstraction anyways. So, you know, line drawings and working with a reader, there isn't a ton of detail or subtlety in it. And so the chemical stuff was rather straightforward to do.
When you say working with a reader, you mean you had a human assistant?
Yeah, for some of the materials, you know, we would sit down with a raised line drawing board, for example, and they would draw, you know, the structure of a sugar or something like that and describe it to me. Meanwhile, you know, I for the rest of the text, I would use the electronic stuff.
This must have been someone who was somewhat knowledgeable about medicine so they could draw these.
Yeah, and one person, for example, was a graduate student in biochemistry.
That was great. So it sounds like you really didn't have too many difficulties in medical school and knew how to overcome these challenges yourself and with little support from your peers and your teachers.
Yeah, we figured it out. I mean, there were times I dusted off my Opticon to read electrocardiograms and to read plain x-rays and things like that. There were times we had to, you know, we had to adapt and think of things on the spot. But overall, it worked.
So I'm kind of curious. I had an Opticon at one time, and it was a device, just for others who don't know, that produced vibrations under your fingers. So supposedly people could read. Now, I could understand looking at line drawings with it, but I could never read with it, text. Were you ever successful at doing that?
I was very slow with text, but luckily you're right. I tended to use it for line diagrams, and that's essentially what an electrocardiogram is. It's about 12 rising and falling line patterns that you look at superimposed over a grid. And so you could use an Opticon for a task like that.
Mm-hmm. How well did it work for an x-ray? Those tend to be fairly low contrast.
Right. Well, the trick with the x-ray was to use the contrast control on the Opticon to look at the same image at a few different intensity levels and then sort of reconstruct it in your head. It was what's gray, what's white, what's black. That was the challenge with the Opticon for that.
It's interesting you talk about reconstructing those images in your head. I guess being visually impaired, you learn to do a lot in your head. I know when I used to do a complex set of equations, you know, I'd do step one, and then the next step that was ever written down was like step 10. And all the stuff in between that most sighted people would have written down was just too much trouble for me. So a lot happened in my head. And I assume that happened with images and your chemical equations.
Yeah, I had this wonderful geometry teacher in high school. He told me, he said, Tim, we're going to teach you geometry in your head. So he would say, imagine a plane, Tim, and a line coming out perpendicular. And then, so we would build these three-dimensional geometric problems, you know, as part of proofs. And I would, the only thing I would have was the space in my head, keeping it all straight. So I think that's where that started.
You know, sometimes I think that can be an advantage because, well, I did a lot of programming at Xerox and, you know, you kind of able to keep the whole structure of something big in your head because you're used to doing it. You've been exercising that facet of your brain.
Yeah, and I was just doing some research for an unrelated purpose, but there are brain scans of visually impaired folks that show that sometimes when braille reading, sometimes when doing complex verbal memory tasks, the occipital cortex, so the part of the brain that's usually involved in vision, actually gets activated in visually impaired folks. So, you know, the brain may actually rearrange to use the real estate to help blind folks with that kind of task.
So when you got out of medical school, what branch of medicine did you decide to go into?
Yeah, it took me a while. I was debating between doing a combination internal medicine and psychiatry, or just psychiatry. And I met with one of my mentors who I really respect. And, you know, I was building a family and those sort of things. And we decided that the dual degree, you know, I should have given up on that a long time ago, but was not the thing. And I decided to go into psychiatry.
And so you've been a practicing psychiatrist for a while now. Have you run into any obstacles or barriers or anything?
That's a good question. Not really. I mean, you know, as a psychiatrist, it's about the patient's needs and the relationship and all those sort of things. And certainly there are patients who, you know, I don't click with, but I think every psychiatrist has that experience, and I don't hang it on my visual impairment. But overall, it's been a very rewarding practice so far.
And you navigate with a guide dog. Do you think the guide dog has any impact on your interactions with the patients?
I'm sure it does. So when I started my psychiatry residency, I had a large, serious German Shepherd. And then about 4 years ago, I got a tail wagging, happy Labrador Golden Retriever cross. And so the impression they give to the patients, I'm sure, is different. The current dog gives a lot more unconditional positive regard.
I like the way you phrase that. You must be a psychiatrist.
Did you do that on purpose, or did that just happen? It was the luck of the draw, which dog you got.
It was the luck of the draw. This Labrador has a lot of pep and get up and go. And that's one thing I look for in a working dog.
So I was thinking there's kind of two levels of acceptance. And one is, you know, some patients may come in and express some reluctance to work with a blind physician. There also might be, you know, your colleagues in terms of referrals. And you haven't run into any of those kinds of issues?
Not really. I mean, I'm practicing essentially the same place I went through residency. So my colleagues, many of them have known me for quite a while, and I get plenty of referrals. That's not a problem. And on the patient side, you know, I'm sure there is some level of newness or even skepticism perhaps when I meet them. But I think after a while, you know, we form a relationship and things work.
So you don't find your vision limits you in any way in interacting with the patients? I mean, a lot of it is verbal. And I guess even though people have facial expressions, you're not seeing, as a long-term visually impaired person, you learn how to read them without seeing the impressions on their faces.
Yeah, yeah, I definitely do. You know, I pay attention to the direction of their gaze, and, you know, their facial expressions definitely change the sort of the sound output they make, and all, you know, how their body moves and all that stuff. And at the end of the day, people want to be understood. So they may say things to me that they wouldn't say to somebody else. You know, they may tell me, oh, I got a new jacket, you know, and instead of expecting their psychiatrist to notice they got a new jacket. And between all those things, it seems to work.
Oh, so there can be some positives also here.
I think so, too. And you know, I'm probably not the most intimidating guy either, you know, and maybe that plays into their level of openness and things like that.
Well, we talked to a TV reporter several months ago who used a guide dog during his interviews, and he thought that was a nice icebreaker and often opened up conversations quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's certainly something to talk about.
This TV reporter, that was a part-time thing he did on the side. His day job was being a social worker. And he actually said he thought his visual impairment as a social worker was actually a positive. That, you know, he'd deal with a lot of patients nearing end of life, and their family and friends would walk in the room and see them and just look horrified, or the patient wouldn't want other people to see them in the condition they were in. And he would walk in with the guide dog, and the patient would feel like, wow, this guy isn't looking at me, so he's not judging me based on how awful I look. Now we can just interact as peers without that being the big elephant on the table.
Right. Yeah, I have heard that too, that some people think I, you know, perceive them more, you know, equitably because I'm not judging them on how they look.
And that show about the blind TV reporter and social worker was number 1342. And we will have a link to that show in this show's show notes as well.
Actually, half my practice right now is telepsychiatry. So I'm basically doing Skype to people in another geographical area of Wisconsin. So they don't see me moving around my environment. I'm just at a desk. I introduce myself and mention my visual impairment. But the guide dog, especially in those situations, is secondary.
Now for this week's high-tech item, a sophisticated program that Tim created to help him envision molecular structures of chemical compounds, as well as some final thoughts from Tim. I understand that you've done some research in some sort of biochemical molecular structure, something or other, where sighted scientists would have these 3D models of molecules, and you developed another way of depicting them.
Right, yeah. it was one of those necessity is the mother of invention things. So I was studying the structure of a protein from a bacteria involved in how it causes disease, and I needed to better understand the structure beyond the tools I had. So I started out saying, well, what if this was just a database problem? And I moved a box or a sphere around in three dimensions and asked, well, what's in that sphere? And so I started with that approach, but then I realized that I needed a way to sort of anchor that to the overall shape of the protein. So I came up with a system that used audio cues to tell you where you were in space in sort of a box around the protein. So higher pitches would be higher up, louder sounds would be coming towards you, and then it would move to your left and right ears for the third dimension. And so I wrote that tool using some old MIDI skills I had and a lot of publicly available routines, and it slapped a graphic interface on so sighted folks could see what I was doing and made a program.
And what programming language did you use for that?
This is how old I am. It's written in Perl.
And this program is called TimMole. So that's how it's pronounced. It's spelled TimMole, and you can Google it and find lots of links to original papers and other news reports on the topic.
So what advice would you have for other visually impaired people who are thinking of pursuing such a profession?
Well, I think you can get hooked on the goal and lose track of enjoying the process. I enjoyed science all the way through, including my undergraduate. And I think if you just were so focused on the end, you would miss a very, you know, exciting, sometimes hard, but wonderful process.
You know, that's probably true of a lot of endeavors. If you're not enjoying the process, there's no point in getting to the end.
Right, right. I mean, and there will be days where you're asking yourself, why am I doing this? But overall, you know, you got to be able to enjoy it as you're going along.
And if you enjoy the process, it's a lot more likely that you'll be successful and be driven to work harder to do the things you want to do. So as usual, you can find the links to many of the items we talked about in the show in our show notes associated with this show. And that would be at our website, www.eyesonsuccess.net. And remember, you can also use our search feature to put in a show number, a topic, or a keyword to automatically find links to the audio and show notes for previous shows in our archives.
That's it for show number 1423. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about the ORCAM vision system. ORCAM consists of a small camera that's attached to your eyeglasses and connected to a pocket-sized computer. The system identifies objects, recognizes and reads text, and speaks it all to you through a bone conduction earpiece. We'll speak with Hannah, one of the developers of the device, and Eliav from the marketing team. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to hosts@eyesonsuccess.net or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, hosted and produced by Nancy Goodman-Torpey and Peter Torpey and distributed by WXXI Reach Out Radio. For detailed information or a full archive of programs, visit www.eyesonsuccess.net. You can also follow us on Facebook and Audioboo at Eyes on Success and on Twitter at @_EyesOnSuccess. We hope you will join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. Thanks for listening to Eyes on Success, and have a nice day.